Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Thursday, the 2014 World Cup kicks off with host nation Brazil playing Croatia. All told, 31 teams will play a total of 64 matches. And at some point, you can bet there will be at least one pivotal penalty kick that decides whether one team advances to the next round or not. In that tense football face-off between goalie and kicker, each is considering, should I go left or right? As Stephen Dubner will tell you, the best option may be to do neither. Dubner is host of the WNYC podcast Freakonomics Radio, which professes to expose the hidden side of everything. Dubner, along with the economist Stephen Levitt, is also co-author of the books Freakonomics, Super Freakonomics, and most recently, Think Like a Freak. We wanted to get his freaky take on some of this week's headlines. So we're going to begin with the World Cup. But first, hello, Stephen.
Hi, Virginia. How are you?
Very well and very excited about the World Cup this week, I must say.
Me too. I'm glad you are, because in my house it's a big deal, but in many houses near where I live, it is not a big deal.
Well, you know, given what you do, you have some perspective on this, all data-driven. So if you were a professional soccer player, let's go back to that kickoff. Lining up, what would you do?
Yeah, so the data are really, really clear. If you look at penalty kicks at the elite level, so the best players in the world, you know, they're pretty good at making these kicks. They can put the ball where they want to in the goal, and the keeper's standing there just 12 yards away. So kickers almost always go to either the left corner or the right corner, where it's hard for the keeper to get to. Keepers, therefore, almost always, even more often actually, jump to either the left corner or the right corner as the kicker is approaching the ball, because he kicks it so fast and he's so close that you kind of have to commit yourself. But as it turns out, if you really want to give yourself the best chance for success, you want to kick it dead center, which is extremely nerve-wracking and counterintuitive, because that's where the keeper is standing at the moment that you approach. But you know that only 2% of the time the keeper will actually stay in the center. He almost always leaps left to right. So if you really want to help your team win, you will go center. That's what the data says. Mm. But that's not what kickers do very often. And the reason, as we fathom at least, is that it has to do with incentives, kind of private incentives or personal incentives versus public. If you go left or right and make a great kick, but the keeper manages to stop it, well, you know, you did the right thing, but the keeper did a great thing. If, however, you go center and the kicker manages to stop it, then you just look like a pathetic fool.
That's what I'm thinking. Don't people get killed for this in the football world?
They do get. They get killed for offenses even less than this, or you have to relocate your family. So this metaphor, this is how we begin. This is the first chapter of Think Like a Freak. So it's true that it happens to be nice and timely with the World Cup starting this week, but really we mean it also as a metaphor for life in general, which is, you know, we're all driven by incentives. We often respond more strongly to the ones that affect us personally than doing what might be better for the greater good. In this case, the football team, soccer team versus ourselves, or in a larger sense, the world versus ourselves.
Well, let's bring that metaphor, draw out that metaphor a little. It's kind of subversive thinking. You're doing what nobody thinks you will do because it seems so obvious. Now, is that part of thinking like a freak?
I think so. I mean, I think the higher up you go in society, the more education you have and the more you tend to hang around people who have a ton of education, the kind of people who listen to public radio, let's say, we are deathly afraid of doing anything that's remotely obvious because it seems too, you know, simple, simplistic. And so a lot of our book we spend kind of advising people or encouraging people to think kind of like a child often. Thinking like a freak is a little bit thinking like a child, which is don't ignore the obvious. Be willing to think small. And I think if we could all be animated a bit by that childlike curiosity and trying to figure stuff out, we would be on the road to coming up with better solutions.
Yeah. So it's more about curiosity than just the data, which calls to mind Itaú Unibanco, Brazil's largest bank, says that according to statistics, Brazil's going to win the World Cup. Ditto Goldman Sachs, I think last week came out with that. But what if I were to ask you who's going to win the World Cup right now? What would you say? Is this about predictions?
One thing that you can be sure of is that most predictions are terrible. So Look, the human animal loves to try to predict the future. And in fact, if you go back to the beginning of, you know, humankind and the earliest religions and philosophies, so much of them were about trying to explain the inexplicable or predict the unpredictable, like what happens after we die. But the fact is that we spend a lot of time and effort and money on trying to predict the future, even though the data suggest that even the very best people in their fields, whether it's economics or politics or sports, they're about as good as a monkey with a dartboard. That's what the data say. And yet we put a lot of faith into predictions. And most people who make big, crazy predictions that are wrong, we forget about them. But if you happen to make one that's right, everybody remembers. So if I pretend, you know, I'll go ahead and say it here. I think Croatia is going to win the 2014 World Cup.
Okay, here comes the hate mail.
Yeah, if they happen to win it, I will be remembered forever for making this ludicrous but what turned out to be true prediction. If, however, Croatia somehow doesn't win the World Cup, it'll be forgotten fine. And so that's what the incentives to predict are strong. If I had to predict right now, I would predict Brazil winning the World Cup for two reasons, or maybe three. A, they're a good team. B, they've won it before. And knowing how to win at an elite level can be pretty valuable. And C, home field advantage is pretty significant in many sports, including soccer. Perhaps not for the reasons that people think, like crowd support or home cooking, all those kind of typical reasons, but for one big factor, which is unconscious or unintentional referee bias, which is to say, if you're a referee in a soccer match, especially where one call can be the difference between winning and losing, even if it's totally subconscious, referees tend to make calls in favor of the home team, if only because referees are human too, and the idea of being pelted by invective or something more physically tangible than invective by 100 or 150,000 people is a scary thought. And so the home field advantage is pretty significant in football.
Stephen Dubner's with me, host of WNYC's podcast Freakonomics Radio. He's also a co-author of most recently Think Like a Freak. We're asking him to teach us how a freak might interpret some of the big news items dominating the headlines this week. Well, let's go to a very large prediction that could have great implications for how we all live. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman this Sunday, his column included President Obama's quotes about climate change deniers. Now, public opinion on climate change, a longstanding problem for policymakers who are hoping to cut carbon emissions. What's the Freakonomics take on this?
So I guess there's a few. The first is people say they respond to moral incentives, and generally they don't. So when you hear me say that, you may get angry or disappointed at least, because we like to think that we, you know, not only do we have good moral compasses, but we obey them. But the fact is that even someone who thinks that climate change is a big problem potentially and that we should respond to it, when you look at the data of what gets people to actually change their behaviors, moral exhortations come in nearly last. Money matters to some degree. The biggest factor that we uncovered, especially when it comes to something like energy consumption, is what I'd call the herd mentality incentive, which is that if everybody else is doing it, then you tend to do it too, even if morally you don't really care that much, even if financially it might cost you a little bit. So, of course, then the idea becomes how do you get a lot of people to get the ball rolling? And that's what we're looking at right now. I think one reason that we've had such a standstill in D.C. is that President Obama, who's super smart on any measurable scale, one thing he doesn't do very often or very well is try to persuade people without insulting them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you see on all sides of this and many other issues. It's a very natural reaction to say, hey, dummies, I'm right here. You are wrong. Get with the program or it's too late. Even if the get with the program or it's too late part resonates with them, the minute you start calling names, even if you're in the right, your opponent is not going to hear the rest of what you say. Even in this legislation to limit carbon emissions state by state, one thing that really interested me is it was pitched as, again, a climate change action when he knows that people who don't like the idea of addressing climate change in this way aren't going to like it. It was curious to me why it wasn't talked about as a pollution issue or a clean air issue, which is what it really is.
So that, I believe, is part of the new tack for the Obama administration, along with using the term climate change instead of global warming. But we have to move on to another controversial issue. Your co-author and collaborator, Stephen Levitt, he's done a lot of research around guns, gun violence. Now, I'm curious about how the two of you are processing the recent bout of mass shootings and this renewal in calls for tighter gun laws.
Well, I should say that the recent bout is not that different from the next to most recent bout, which is not that different from the next to next to most recent bout. I mean, you know, we've got a country where there are a lot of guns, where the availability is relatively easy, and where in some part, at least as a result of those two facts, there are way more mass shootings than anyone in their right mind would want. So, of course, you naturally look to one to explain the other. Are our laws contributing to the number of shootings? So the best short answer I could give would be yes, but probably not the laws that most of us think about. In other words, most gun control propositions, at least of the past 20 or 30 years, wouldn't do a very good job of keeping guns out of the hands of the kinds of people who most typically use guns in a way that horrifies society, which is to say criminals, because whenever you crack down on illicit market, the illicit market has its way of working its magic, and those who have some kind of mental illness or instability where they might be aided by the availability of guns, and indeed some changes in gun laws might have prevented some of those shootings, but you're dealing with a population of people who have a set of evil activities in mind and are going to find a way to carry it out. And that is in some ways a different problem. So in this country, we have somewhere about like 300 million, maybe more guns in circulation. They're not perishable. They're not going anywhere. So you could choke off every single new gun from here to the end of time, and you're still going to have a lot of guns around. Then you have countries like in Scandinavia, where the rate of ownership is higher than here, and you don't have many of these crimes. So a lot of things that people are in favor of, gun buybacks, turn out to be, according to the data, entirely ineffective. What kind of person participates in a gun buyback? Somebody who was not going to use that gun anyhow for anything. And so you see a lot of posturing and a lot of heartbreak, but we don't see that the current type of gun laws that have been introduced or proposed would do what we want them to do.
I know you mentioned the controversy over climate change and not thinking that talking about it would change behavior. Of course, there was a big backlash to your findings that legalizing abortion had a great effect on lowering crime, more so than tightening gun laws. But I'm wondering about that. You know, you talked to the father whose child was killed in gun violence. You can say to them, tighter gun laws don't actually lower gun violence. I'm thinking that thinking like a freak could make for some pretty uncomfortable social situations. How do you cope with that? How do you cope with that kind of offense that thinking really in this very different way could produce?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, when you have the opportunity to explain yourself at some length and to have the person you're explaining to talk back to you, whether to offer a counter proposal or just to offer feedback of any kind, is really good. And it's better than just putting out a headline that says, you know, gun control will work or abortion lowered crime. One of the big steps in Think Like a Freak that we argue is that when you want to solve a problem, the first thing you need to do is put away your moral compass temporarily. If you make every decision based on what your moral compass tells you, you may sleep well at night, but you may not solve the problem very well, because when you let your moral compass tell you what's right, whether it's guns, climate change, abortion, politics, whatever, you will inevitably think you know the solution before you've even entertained a number of theories. And so that's this is a different way of problem solving. Thinking like a freak will definitely make you a little unpopular occasionally, but I would argue in the long run, it's good for you and hopefully it's good for society.
Much to think about there. Stephen Dubner, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia. Great to talk to you.
Stephen Dubner, host of Freakonomics Radio, co-author of three now Freakonomics books, most recently Think Like a Freak. There's more in the book, a leak to Freakonomics Radio's podcast at wordofmouthradio.org. And Stephen, for the record, Croatia, his pick for the World Cup championship. You heard it here first.
You heard it here first and last, probably, yeah.